Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look at the explosive situation in Honduras in the broader context of Central America in crisis, with Guatemala a criminal state, Nicaragua losing its democracy, and Honduras on the brink of civil war. We'll be joined by Dr. Kevin Casas Zamora, who was Costa Rica's vice president as well as its minister of national planning and economic policy. He's now a senior fellow in foreign policy in at the Brookings Institution's Latin American Initiative. And he'll be joining us in a moment. And then we'll look at this healthcare debate, or the non-debate, in a week where the president's Obama's healthcare initiative was swept aside by media focus on the birthers, a group of people who believe that President Obama is not an American citizen, is an undocumented alien, in spite of manifest evidence to the contrary. We also found our media obsessed and dominated by an argument between a cop and a professor. So in spite of that, we'll make an attempt to look at both the politics and the economics of healthcare with Tom Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He's a specialist in how politics and money intersect, the author of The Golden Rule, Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and Too Big to Fail, The Paulson Put, Presidential Politics and the Global Financial Meltdown. And he'll be joined by Professor Michael Intrilligate, who's both a professor of economics and political science at UCLA, a specialist in healthcare economics. And then in the final segment, we'll be joined by the star of a new movie that satirizes the behind-the-scenes machinations that led to the Iraq War, the movie In the Loop, which is brilliantly funny and painfully true. Has opened this week, and we'll be joined by one of the stars, Mimi Kennedy. I'm now joined by Dr. Kevin Casas Zamora, who was Costa Rica's vice president as well as its minister of national planning and economic policy. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy in the Brookings Institution's Latin American Initiative, and he's authored several studies on political finance, elections, democratization, and civil-military relations in Latin America. And Dr. Casas Zamora, the crisis or the explosive situation in Honduras is a part of a broader landscape which you've been sort of trying to bring our attention to, in as much as Latin America, Central America itself, could be in crisis, where Guatemala is, for all intents and purposes, a criminal state. Nicaragua is losing its democracy. And Honduras is on the brink of civil war. Do you think anybody in Washington understands that?
Thanks for having me, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Yes, I mean, the question of what's happening in Honduras certainly matters well beyond the country itself, well beyond Honduras. Number one, what's happening in Honduras is a serious setback in the process of democratic consolidation in Latin America. You know, the sight of a group of military officers holding a freely elected president at gunpoint and shuffling him on a plane and flying him all the way to Costa Rica is a throwback to a era that we all thought gone in Latin America. So that's number one. Number two, it's also a very serious test for U.S. policy towards Latin America. And we all saw President Obama trying very successfully to relaunch U.S.-Latin America relations on a new basis at the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad a few weeks ago. So this is the first serious test of that effort. And number three, as you mentioned, this whole fiasco in Honduras speaks to a broader crisis of democratic governance in Central America. Central America has pretty much disappeared from the news for the best part of 20 years. which is quite remarkable because Washington in particular was totally obsessed with Central America during the 80s, and then it simply vanished, and now it's coming back with a vengeance. I certainly hope that someone somewhere in Washington is paying attention. So far, throughout this crisis, the U.S. has been rather reluctant to own the crisis and do something significant about it, and I hope that changes.
Well, there will be an opportunity on Tuesday when the deposed President of Honduras, Zelaya, meets with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Do you think that she's aware of what a tinderbox this is?
I guess she is. She had a very successful intervention in this crisis when she pretty much set up the whole mediation process that took place in Costa Rica with President Oscar Arias as the mediator. That process, by now, it's pretty obvious that the process fell through and that it wasn't successful. So at this point, it's become increasingly obvious to anyone that the one significant actor that can have a difference, that can make a difference in this crisis, is the U.S. And there are zillions of reasons for this. I mean, number one being the very heavy influence that the U.S. has played in Honduras over the years. So I certainly hope that she decides to take a more active role in this crisis. And you know, again, there are many reasons for this. I mean, one of them, which I think is crucial, is that it sends a message in terms of the U.S. ability to have an influence on different kinds of diplomatic crises. If the U.S. is not able to play a constructive role in solving this crisis in Honduras, I certainly doubted that they will be able to do anything about the really complicated crises that are out there, about, you know, Israel and Palestine, Korea, the recurring problems between India and Pakistan. Those things are much more difficult and delicate. If they can't solve Honduras, I can see how they will be able to have a difference on those.
Well, Dr. Kevin Casas-Zamora, let's give the audience some evidence, if you will, as to why this is a potential crisis and it has to be dealt with and it needs adult supervision. And, a lot of people dismiss what's going on with the ousted president of Honduras showing up at the border with a lot of television cameras and then putting his toe across the border, and the Honduran military and the government that replaced him threatened to arrest him. They didn't do that. Why should we be taking this seriously? I suppose in the back of my mind is the notion that, back in the 60s, Honduras and El Salvador went to war over a soccer game. So I don't know whether that's indicative of anything, but why does this concern you?
Well, number one, as you suggest in your comment and your question, there's the potential for violence. If President Zelaya, the ousted president, that is, finally decides to go back to Honduras, I think there's the potential for some serious unrest. This is a country, and we have to bear this in mind, that is heavily armed. Everybody has a gun in Honduras, and that's a legacy of the civil wars and a legacy of a number of things. But
so
I
was going to say it's the National Rifle Association's ideal country then.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, even though historically speaking, political violence has been rather tame in Honduras, you definitely have the potential for violence in a situation where the country is polarized. So that's one good reason. But as I said before, I mean, there are broader reasons why this matters. beyond Honduras. I mean, it matters as a test to U.S. policy towards Latin America. It matters as a test to the U.S. ability to have a positive influence in solving a diplomatic crisis, you know, very, very close to its own borders. And it also matters as a test as to the solidness of democratic institutions in Latin America. But there's something else. I mean, there's something else that bothers me, you know, in this whole situation, which is the notion that, well, what happened in Honduras was pretty serious, regardless of the fact that President Zelaya himself was largely responsible for the political crisis. The fact that the military intervened the way they did was simply unacceptable. Yet, and even though the international community has been totally unanimous in its condemnation of the coup, nobody seems to be willing to do much about it at this point. So it gives you with a very disturbing thought that when one of these things happens, either people don't do anything because you're a small country and nobody cares about you, or alternatively, you're a very big country like Russia when Russia invaded Georgia and nobody dares to do anything about it. So either way, either nobody cares or nobody dares, but international law is losing its ability to be upheld, and that's pretty serious.
So Dr. Kevin Casas-Zamora, what role is Chavez, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, playing in this? I know his television network, since he's basically gotten rid of all the other networks, is playing up this, and clearly he has a hand in this. But I can't see any kind of ideological connection in the sense that Chavez himself was a part of the military and tried a military coup in 92 and then successfully became the president and has never relinquished his military behavior. And Zelaya was deposed by the military, and Zelaya, of course, is a land-owning oligarch. So where's the ideological common ground here, if you will?
This is a very complicated story and a very murky story. At some point during his administration, President Zelaya, somewhat surprisingly, decided to veer left and to establish rather close links to Hugo Chavez and his Bolivarian revolution. Why he did that is totally unclear. As you mentioned, he's a wealthy man, and he's the quintessential product of the Honduran oligarchy, and yet he decided to become a significant social reformer in Honduras, which is not a bad thing. Let me remind everybody that Honduras is one of the very poorest countries in Latin America. So at some point, he decided that he wanted to become a great social reformer, and he thought that the Bolivarian discourse and the connection to Hugo Chavez was probably instrumental to that end. Beyond that, I don't see any deep ideological connection between Zelaya and Hugo Chavez. Yet, and this is crucial to understand, regardless of the deep ideological connection or not between these two men, the perception that Zelaya was becoming very close to Hugo Chavez, even at the personal level, has played a crucial role in this crisis. For a significant part of the elite in Honduras, this is absolutely unacceptable. These people are totally paranoid about the role of Hugo Chavez, and really think that Hugo Chavez wakes up every morning thinking of ways to down Honduras in one gulp. I don't think that's necessarily true, but that's the perception, and they are acting upon that perception.
Well, just in the last minute, Dr. Kevin Casasamora, again, the former vice president of Costa Rica, what? Why are you so concerned, though, of the, in terms of this flashpoint of Honduras being having the potential for a regional conflicts? Because I understand that Guatemala has essentially been suborned by criminal gangs and international crime and drug traffickers, mm-hmm. and the central government is weak there, and Ortega in Nicaragua is rolling back democracy just as Chavez is in Venezuela. So give us a quick sketch of why you're concerned that this could be a flashpoint for broader troubles in Central America.
I mean, I don't think the situation in Honduras itself has the potential to spark, any kind of bigger problem in Central America. But it is part of a trend. It is part of a trend that includes the demise of democracy in Nicaragua, and also the what I would call almost the collapse of the state in Guatemala. It's a country that's totally overrun by organized crime, and it has serious statehood issues, as it were. So I guess my final reflection would be that given that Central America is back on the news again, and for all the wrong reasons, and being so close to the United States, someone in Washington should start paying attention. Benign neglect at this point regarding Central America is no longer an option.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dr. Kevin Casasamora.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Dr. Kevin Casasamora, who was recently Costa Rica's vice president as well as Minister for National Planning and Economic Policy. He's now a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution's Latin American Initiative. I'm now speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He received his PhD from Princeton University and taught formerly at MIT and the University of Texas in Austin. He's the author and co-author of many books and articles, including Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. His Too Big to Fail, The Paulson Put, Presidential Politics and the Global Financial Meltdown Part 1, From Shadow Financial System to Shadow Bailout, was co-authored with Robert Johnson, is in the current International Journal of Political Economy. And covering the economic side, we'll be also joined by Dr. Michael Intrilligate, who is both a professor of economics and political science at UCLA. He specializes in the areas of health economics, economic theory, and strategies and arms control. In health economics, Professor Intrilligate conducted an analysis of the major policy issues in the economics of healthcare in the United States, including a proposal for healthcare reform involving an expansion of the Medicare program. So let's start with the politics of healthcare. In political terms, Thomas Ferguson, this was a week where President Obama attempted to put the healthcare debate front and center, but the whole thing was swept aside by the media's focus on the birthers, a ridiculous paranoid movement of people who deny that Obama is a citizen. And they were also obsessed, and they still are, about an argument between a cop and a professor. What explains this? Do you have any ideas?
Well, here we are talking about how folks try to sort of deal with mass politics. You know, and the White House had some role in that, in the sense that they chose to make the president came back to it, I think, actually three times in the case of the arrest of Professor Gates. Now, you know, that's quite well worth talking about, but it is peculiar given the amount, you know, given all the other things like health care that are also on the agenda. It is remarkable, and as you say, the Obama birth business is, if anything, slightly crazier. You know, I think we should just accept that an awful lot of people are trying to shape public debates, and distraction's part of public debates. I mean, both the White House and its opponents have spent a great deal of time studying how to sort of distract, change the subject, and sometimes they think and, you know, intensify some of their partisans. But we probably should get on to talking about the health care case itself, which is, after all, in the end, the thing that this week that will just affect everybody of every race, creed, and color in the United States for generations to come.
So, Tom Ferguson, you expect that the noise will go away and there'll be a little more light and a little less heat?
Nope. I'm frankly, when did you ever see that in American politics when big financial interests were at stake? Now, I would think that you'll see, if anything, more distractions, more nonsense, and not that everything. The Gates arrest is quite merit some public discussion, but that's not the same. It's not the same level of outcome as the Obama birth nonsense, which really does seem to me, in a well ordered state, probably you'd only be talking about that in an asylum. But hey.
Well,
I think it's just going to get worse. I mean, the plain facts of the matter are is that you probably can't even 20 minutes of public attention spent on the basic economics and politics of this debate would probably move public opinion substantially. And so an awful lot of folks who are happy with the status quo don't want that to happen.
But there aren't an awful lot of folks that are happy with the status quo. From the anecdotal evidence that I have, it's quite the reverse. But that is what is being spun. And it seems that on the Republican side, their strategy is to do nothing, frustrate, delay, and deny. And I'm fearful that the press is playing along with that, because they're treating this whole thing as process, which is what they do with everything in Washington. They make it a process story, and that they're setting this thing up as Obama's Waterloo, in as much as they, along with the Republicans, it appears many people have an investment in this thing failing. And
couple points. On this stuff, I think the partisan character, there is a partisan quality to it in the sense, yes, there's a big political party clash going here, but the disputes within the Democratic Party are huge. And in that sense, this is not Democrats or Republicans. You will forgive my, for just to be understood simply and clearly, you have the representatives of the health industrial complex incorporated versus the rest of the population. And, that's a bipartisan force. It's a really powerful, the Blue Dog Democrats, for example, are clearly, at the moment, there's as much trouble inside the Democratic section of Congressman Waxman's health care committee as between the political parties. Now, the striking thing to me is that when you listen to the Blue Dog Democrats, they talk endlessly about budget balance, fiscal responsibility, and that stuff. Now, you go back to October of 2008. I took the trouble to sort of pull this out this morning. A majority of those Blue Dogs actually voted for the TARP programs, these sort of giveaway to the banks. And I don't want to go on about TARP. I've done that in other contexts. I will just try to characterize it briefly as a ridiculous giveaway to banks. It just should never have been done in the form it was. It is quite remarkable to me the way Blue Dogs vote for that. They also, incidentally, voted for the auto bailouts, which are a different kettle of fish, and they're much less money than the bank bailouts. And then suddenly on health care, they seem to sort of lose their voice or perhaps just find it. They're suddenly concerned about the budget again.
Well, let me bring in Dr. Michael Antrilligator, who is both a professor of economics and political science at UCLA. He specializes in healthcare economics. Dr. Antrilligator, it does seem that when the press frames this argument about the Blue Dogs and the intra-Democratic Party squabbles between Waxman and the Blue Dogs, it's always framed as the Blue Dogs being fiscally conservative, as though there's some ideology involved, when it's manifestly clear that all of them are receiving massive campaign donations from the insurance and pharma and HMOs.
Well, Ian, you're absolutely right. I mean, the special interests have dominated this and have in their pocket many of the congresspeople that are involved in this debate, and they have provided funding and other support for members of Congress. And I think that stymies the whole idea of reform.
So is that the tactic then, to kill it slowly with kindness?
Well, I don't know if it's slowly, but they're killing it, whatever it is. And I'm just afraid we're repeating the same experience we had with Hillary Clinton's proposal back in '93, that nothing will get done, we'll be stymied. First they'll go off on their August recess, and they'll discuss with their constituents and so forth, and they'll come back and they'll decide that we don't want to do this. And I'm afraid that's where things stand. So Obama's putting all his eggs in this one basket, which it may be a mistake politically, because I think that nothing is going to get done.
But I recall in the Hillary Clinton days, whatever it was that they were meeting in secret about was already, we were told, the press told us it was a complete catastrophe and a train wreck, and that is still what we hear. I don't know enough about what they're doing here. It seems that Obama has let the Kennedy's committee draft it, and now it's in the Finance Committee in the Senate, and they're all sort of marking it up in the back room. So I defy anybody to tell me what the hell's going on.
Well, that's true. We don't get all the information, but I think they're knocking out one another's proposals. Baucus has come out totally against a single payer system, which I think makes the most sense for this country today. And he won't even listen to it. He won't even hold hearings on it.
So much for democracy, eh?
Exactly. Baucus from Montana, a very small state, is totally dominant in this debate. And he has a particular point of view.
He also gets about 87% of his money from out of state, by the way.
That's
right.
Right. And, you know, the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical houses and so forth have these people in their pocket, is my impression. And my prediction is that nothing is going to get done. It'll be a repeat of Hillary Clinton's disaster.
So do you share that pessimism, Tom Ferguson?
Well, look, anybody... I often tell my students, if you want a happy ending, watch it in American politics. Go see a Disney movie. I'm not going to stand around and say... give you Pollyanna reports. I might have a slightly different view, I actually doubt that Mike or I very disagree hardly at all. My take is the Obama administration from the beginning tried to do this in a bipartisan fashion. I think that's a nice thing to try for 3 weeks, but the plain fact of the matter is, the Republicans won't go along, and that's that. And then the second thing they did, exactly as Mike said, was, yeah, they're letting the Congress write the legislation. They are not, and they are not using their own political patronage or their own sort of political force. And only this week, did the president finally get around to talking to the public. Sort of in a direct sense, and talking to people in the middle of July doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, what's he talking about? That was not a very focused press conference today.
I do not dispute, although, in fact, it wasn't nearly as unfocused and bad as a lot of TV commentators said.
Right.
And I do think there was a substantial amount of information in it. They made too many initial compromises in the design of the legislation. Mike's absolutely right that single payer is the way to go. It's just preposterous to sort of keep handing, in effect, the role of where the government could do it easily and cheaply to just hand it to insurance companies to then just mark it up and pay executives and then fight among themselves to sort of get rid of... people who need insurance and things like that. This is insane. I mean, maybe I could talk for 1 minute what I understand to be the evolution of the Democratic Party strategy on this. If you ever since health care failed, they've been sort of casting about. The first thing you could see in the mid 2002-2003, it was in Kerry's program, is they made a lot of overtures to insurers where effectively what they were offering to do was have the state pick up the cost for the really expensive insured people and give the rest of the business to the insurers. Another way of rephrasing what I've is to say they were going to pay the insurers to sort of cover expensive risks. Well, not surprisingly, a lot of insurers like that. You still find them nibbling at the idea of a large public plan, but you know they want to be paid to do the insurance system, even though there's just no justification for you know letting 20 of them do it. Then recently, the administration struck an arrangement with the pharmaceutical industry, which, as best as I can see, involves promising them they won't bargain down the costs of drugs very much, and they will give them a lot of new business. As a result, a huge block of the pharmaceutical folks came over to the side of the legislation, and there are actually ads running. I mean, this is water running uphill. I mean, I've been doing political finance for about 20 years, and I will tell you, I never saw anything like this. You've got pharmaceutical companies paying for ads defending Democrats in favor of this health care bill in their home districts. But they haven't been able to reach an arrangement with the insurers, and there are vast numbers of folks offering what I'll just term, I mean, Mike could undoubtedly do this in more detail, specialty services, of which that's just limitless, who are afraid that, you know, their particular form of thing will, they won't be allowed to overprice it, and they won't be able to do it in the quantity that they've become accustomed to, since their customers cannot, you know, gainsay them. I mean, whatever the polls say about people liking their doctors, the plain fact is that they cannot really tell when they are being, one, overcharged, or two, being given services they don't need. And so, you know, basically, this is a problem to a considerable extent, I have to say. I think the administration brought on itself with its sort of cowardice in the face of special interest and money. And now they've got to play catch-up. And I agree with Mike, this whole show could go down. I also think that if it does go down, there's a reasonable chance that in a year, with the unemployment rate still around 10% or so, that the Obama administration could suffer the fate of the Clinton administration in 1994. For that reason, I think in the end, you'll probably see some kind of deal. I'm looking for a second-rate, high-cost deal that is not good for the population. But I think if they come back with empty hands after all this, they know they'll be held to pay.
So, Mike Intrilligator, do you agree with Tom Ferguson that the Blue Dogs, who are clearly in the pocket of the insurance companies at the moment, will they see their political survival on the line if this becomes Obama's Waterloo, as the, a lot of Republicans want, and the press seem to be feeding that kind of contest paradigm? If it comes down to that they end up empty-handed, it's a big defeat to Obama, and in 2010 the Republicans come back strong in the House and Senate, will that portent get these guys to make some kind of cosmetic deal so they can all sort of celebrate passage of the bill?
I doubt if there'll be any bill at all. I think what's going to happen is that Congress will go back to their home districts and talk to their constituents, and their constituents are not happy with this proposal or how Obama's handling it or anything.
But why aren't they? That's the key, though, isn't it, Mike? This is the key. When you both of you are in favor of single payer, it's not even a starter. It's not in the public debate. The people out there that need to know about it don't know about it, and what they know about it is all ridiculous propaganda. So let's look ahead to the notion that it gets torpedoed. People will be angry because the status quo is unacceptable. Who's going to tell them about what they're missing out on?
That's a good question. Unless Obama changes course very significantly, I don't think there's anybody out there who can tell them that. But somebody should be telling them that. Many of us have been talking about single payer for years and years. There's this recent book by Howard Dean, Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform, which talks about this and talks about how it might be funded through carbon tax, which is an innovative idea. That's a new idea. And I think that should be taken seriously. But no one's talking about it. I'm very pessimistic.
I think we need some solid evidence on public opinion. I know that in the last couple weeks, the New York Times and other organs have been saying, well, the public is skeptical. Well, the same Times was publishing polls just a month or so ago showing a fairly substantial majority of the public wanted health care reform. Now, I have watched people, in effect, an unsympathetic being would say lie, and other folks, they might say just mislead inadvertently, whatever. There's an awful lot of assertions around about what the public thinks. The only solid evidence I've seen, which was, you know, admittedly 5 or 6 weeks old, showed a substantial majority of the public actually wanted health care reform. I'd like to see some polls. And the problem here that are, you know, reasonably honestly framed, I perhaps should add, it's not clear to me that the public's opinion in this is driving anything. And I really do think when you look particularly at some of the blue dogs, I mean, this gentleman from Tennessee, for Bert Gordon, for example, I think he ought to register as a wholly owned subsidiary of various hospital companies and things like that over his whole career. And Mike Ross and some of these other folks, I was looking through these numbers this morning, Zach Spence of Ohio, this guy Matheson from Utah, these are all Democratic blue dogs I'm talking, and they're all on the subcommittee on health of Waxman's committee. These folks, there really are very large sums of cash, either in some cases, if you they're right now, that is to say, you look at the money rolling in now, it's amazing. In other cases, what you find is very high career patterns from health care, and then suddenly, for some odd reason, not too much cash. Now, that looks like an effort to forestall criticism. I have seen this in congressional behavior. Money's talking here. I'm much less persuaded that the public is, and I don't think we should jump to the conclusion that the public doesn't want it until at least we've got some evidence.
Well, when to justify the blue dogs, not just the fact that they're taking money, which undercuts their so-called ideology of fiscal conservatism, but if they come from these purple states where normally Democrats don't get elected, shouldn't their focus then be to educate the constituents rather than capitulate to ignorance?
Yeah, but again, come back to my point. It's not clear that the constituents need much educating. I mean, in the New York Times poll of about, I think it was 6 to 8 weeks ago, two-thirds of the population, roughly, it might have been 64%, wanted health care reform.
You know, right. Well, Mike and Trilliger, why are you so pessimistic? If Tom is right, and I think he is, I think people out there they know that it's not working for them because they have to pay the damn bills, and they keep getting, the insurance companies hire professional doctors, many retired, to go through and literally deny people care. You couldn't have a worse bunch of people in charge. It's like putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. It is thoroughly dysfunctional to have insurance people running health care. And if that message gets across, that this is kind of a mafia that doesn't bring anything to the table, that just extracts and doesn't provide, then you'd, I think you'd be clarifying this debate a little.
Well, people realize there's a huge problem out there that has to be addressed. I mean, look at health care is now 17% going up to 18-19% of our total national income, which is ridiculous, which is way above any other country in the world, and we're not getting the outcomes in terms of better health care at all. In fact, we have one of the worst records as far as health care is concerned. So people realize there's a problem out there, but many are complacent. They feel that it applies to the other guy because they have health coverage, and they're fooling themselves because they don't have health coverage. People think that they're covered, but as you say, the insurance companies will deny claims. They do that right and left for various reasons, loopholes of one sort or another. And so even though people think they're covered, they're actually not covered at all. I think what we need is a public education campaign to point out how people are really not covered, that people don't get the benefits that they think that they have. And then people may wake up to the fact that we need some kind of a different system altogether. It's not just an easy, quick fix. It's a total rethinking of the whole system. We made this mistake years ago in World War II. It goes way back to then. when the unions couldn't get wage increases and they negotiated for fringe benefits. One of their fringe benefits was health care. So we tied in health care, health insurance, to employment. That was a huge mistake. We're suffering that mistake now, many, many years later. And you see it now when people are unemployed because of the recession, they lose their health insurance. This is happening for millions of people. But there's a fundamental flaw in our system. We're the only country in the world that has this connection between health care and employment. There's no necessary logic or reason for that kind of connection. It's a historical anachronism in a way. So I think it's not a matter of quick fix, easy solution. And some of the bills I've seen suggest that's what the proponents are doing. But really, it requires a rethinking of the whole system. So that's why I'm in favor of something like a single-payer system, which somehow got ruled out, is off the table. I think we need something like that. But it requires education on the part of our political leaders to explain what's going on here, why there's a disaster.
So, Tom, how do you get an educational program going?
Look, I see this problem somewhat differently, I guess. I mean, I certainly agree about the benefits of single-payer, but every poll I see suggests to me that very large numbers of people are anxious about health care coverage. Folks who are losing their jobs, I think almost without exception, know they're in trouble on their health care, particularly when they look at some of these COBRA stuff. We have less a public education problem than to get people to connect what their representatives are doing with what they want. I mean, the way you fix this problem is to do exactly what some groups did on the economic stimulus, which is they need to run TV ads in the districts of these representatives that are balking and to sort of just simply tell their voters what they're actually doing. There's actually a couple of good papers now which shows you how different congressional behavior is when, the case they actually use is the press. Political ads can do that too. Effectively, you know, you got to have enough cash to reach into these districts and effectively threaten these guys. I mean, their home papers in many cases do not cover them. There's some very good studies of coverage of incumbent U.S. senators, which suggests that in most cases there's long-standing relations between the papers and the representatives, between the senators, sorry, the incumbent senators and the papers. My sense is that what the Obama administration has not been willing to do is make a really good counterargument, and they haven't directed real resources into pressuring these representatives. They've been taking the path of least resistance. They talk about this stuff, but they do actually relatively little, and they haven't put any political capital or real capital into this.
Well, but
and
Tom,
that's what's got to happen.
Right, you're suggesting, in fact, that we have a representative democracy problem, the people that go to Washington aren't representing their constituents, they're representing big money. Now,
not the voice of the people, but money is talking.
Right, so if their normal inclination is to take care of the people that pay their...
Take care of them,
then unless the people show up, it's never going to work. So let me just ask my Controlligator, what does it take to get the people to show up and to shame these people into doing what they should be doing in the first place, which is representing their constituents?
Well, I'm afraid if the people show up, they're going to really reject a large part of the reforms that are being proposed, including Obama's own proposal. The idea of a health care mandate that people have to buy health insurance, people will really resist. It's going to cost them money. It's not clear that they're going to get any benefit out of the thing. They don't like people telling them what to do. You have to buy health insurance. It may make sense nationally, but from an individual point of view, young, healthy people, they don't want to take on the added burden of the cost of private health insurance. Of course, the insurance companies love that idea, but I think when the Congress returns to the districts, they're going to find that people are very much against this proposal, public option, particularly with these mandates.
We just ran this experiment in Massachusetts, and you know, for all the noise about how people don't want to pay for and don't want to have to be forced to buy insurance, you're not looking at mass resistance to the new health care bill. I mean, my sense is that, you know, that's a type of thing. It's sort of like seat belts and other that gets fanned by right-wing media and the press. And, you know, it's an effective diversion. It's pretty, if somebody would take the trouble to talk about your health care problems to this place and your and put the representative's behavior in the context of the cash, you know, a lot of these folks would just suddenly discover their inner humanitarian, at least for I've watched this.
Okay.
One.
Well, look, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Tom.
Okay.
And Mike and Trilligator, but I thank both of you for joining us here in Los Angeles. Tom Ferguson, Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Boston, specializes in money-driven political systems, and Dr. Michael Trilligator is both a healthcare economist and a political science professor at UCLA. I thank you both for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Ian.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
And
now I'm joined by Mimi Kennedy, who is an actress, author, activist. She is the chair of the advisory board of Progressive Democrats of America. She starred in the TV series Dharma and Greg and has appeared in a number of television shows, Ghost Whisperer, ER, Grey's Anatomy, Cold Case, and in a number of movies, including Erin Brockovich. She stars in the new movie as Karen Clark in The Loop, which is a BBC feature playing at the Landmark Theatre at Pico and Westwood Boulevard in West Los Angeles. Next week it's opening wider throughout the state of California and the country. Thank you so much for joining us here today, Mimi.
It's great to talk to you, Ian.
Well, this is painfully funny, but painfully true. I mean, this is a brilliant piece of work that that this director has done. And I take it. Let me start with this. How did you come across him? Did you just go to a casting session or?
Yeah, exactly. I had acquired a new agent. Women of a certain age very often get dropped and sort of drop out of show business. And I'd been doing so much activism that that was where my focus was. But I had acquired a new agent, and his name was Todd Justice, and I thought that was amusing. And one of the first appointments that he sent me on was the BBC, said a lead role. And I called him up and I said, is this the BBC or is this the name for some, you know, BS Bupkis Corporation somewhere? And is it really a lead role? And he said, no, it really is the BBC. And it's a gem of a thing and I'm sending you up for it. So it was an honest-to-God casting call audition, and I was put on tape without seeing anybody except the casting people. And then the director came in, and I improvised with him. And Armando said to me when I showed up for rehearsal in New York, I'm so pleased you're doing this role. I was in despair. I was leaving America the next day. I had not found my Karen. You walked in. Isn't that?
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's a Hollywood story. Yeah.
Now, but I take it that sort of style of improvisation was, I mean, they shot with, what, two cameras? They recorded people even when they're off screen?
Well, what they did was that they set the scene in motion. We would do it as scripted, but there was no lighting or setups the way I'm familiar with doing film here. It was generally lit, and then the two cameras just moved among us, careful, of course, to avoid each other, those cameras. So there was a general sense of where the cameras would be, but they were told to pick up whatever they found most interesting. The cameras are really part of Armando's eyes as a crew, and he lets them find out what they think is good. And we do this script, and then Armando says, let's shoot a loose one. We can just do whatever, you know, do whatever impulses you have. And, of course, his crew that's worked with him a long time knew just what to do. We Americans watching them learned what to do, and we were all kind of in the mix after a while. That's how he does it.
Well, let's bring the audience up to speed here, Mimi Kennedy. And I'll just read a brief summary of the movie so they'll know what we're talking about. And this, of course, is a movie that it's getting extraordinary reviews, and I can't recommend it as much. If Amanda Iannucci's political farce about the road to war through the corridors of power weren't so funny, it would be utterly terrifying. When a British cabinet minister, Simon Fraser, comments publicly that he thinks war is unforeseeable, the result is an immediate bollocking from Malcolm Tucker, the Prime Minister's testy bulldog pushing for war. Unable to clarify his position, Simon is sent to Washington, where, trying desperately to be important, he meets Karen Clark, that's the role that you play, uh-huh, a U.S. State Department official, and General Miller, that's played by the star of Sopranos.
Right? Yep, James Gandolfini.
James Gandolfini, who see him as a transatlantic partner in building a consensus against war. They search for a secret war committee led by Karen's hawkish colleague Linton Barwick. And as Fast demands, as Fast demands, all parties eventually converge for a climactic shuffle between rooms, in this case the United Nations. Wickedly sardonic and filled with secrets, lies, leaks, plugs, and faulty intelligence, and walls, In the Loop leads us behind closed doors to reveal bungling bureaucrats entangled in petty rivalry, obsequious aides jockeying for favor, and a keystone cops of government, including a minister who hopes there's no war because it's bad enough coping with the Olympics, and an unscrupulous bureaucrat who doctors intelligence because he believes that in the land of truth, the man with one fact is king. But don't worry, none of this actually happened, or did it?
Yeah, you read the Downing Street memo?
Well,
we did. Yeah.
Well, what's brilliant, though, is that they don't even mention Iraq in this movie.
No, that is what's brilliant. And Armando said he wanted something timeless, and it is pretty amazing. It's been compared to Dr. Strangelove and its impact as being anti-war generally, like the whole war system, the whole way you go to war, the bloodlessness with which bureaucrats throw around the idea of going to war. You know, only the general in our movie, he says, you know, guys are going to get killed, a lot of them, and this is serious stuff, and we should probably stop this if we can, because it's based on nothing. I mean, it's based on Dr. evidence. All of that is laid out in the movie without any specific reference, and I think that's genius. I mean, that's the genius of a great satirist. It makes me think of Shakespeare.
Right. Well, it also has qualities of Preston Sturges, I think. In that sort of, you know, or Feydeau's farce, really.
Screwball tragedy, I believe, is a phrase that someone threw around.
Right. Well, this guy is clearly incredibly talented. He had something to do with The Office, didn't he, that series?
His is The Thick of It. He may have had something to do with The Office, but I don't know that. It's The Thick of It, an Alan Partridge show. And before that, and this is all available online, I have spent some time this weekend looking at my director's old stuff and laughing until I weep. Because his human observations, he did, I think there was an Armando Iannucci show, it was a sort of sketch comedy, but it's as far from the, you know, overly, well, they have it too in Britain, they call it the fart and fall down school, as opposed to the more literate comedy, but Armando manages real screwball stuff that is really funny and smart, and he has been doing it for a long time, but the Armando Iannucci show, the Alan Partridge, and then the show The Thick of It, that has resumed filming in Britain with a lot of our cast doing what they do in the Prime Minister's, as the Prime Minister's minions.
And on top of that, he's just written a libretto for an opera lampooning plastic surgery.
I love Armando Iannucci. He goes after the really important stuff.
But he did do his homework, apparently. He met with Senate staffers, he met with people at the CIA and the Pentagon, and the United Nations and the State Department.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. That speaks to the special relationship, and the BBC, which we don't really have, the Corporation of Public Broadcasting and our public television stations and public radio is the closest thing that we have to the BBC here. And somehow I think the BBC was a little freer in what it could say and do.
Well, it's set up that way because it's funded, it's politically insulated in its funding source. It's funded by TV licenses and radio licenses. So it's not like PBS is here.
Yeah, it's not corporations giving their foundation board.
Right, and Nixon set up the public broadcasting to fail anyway, to make it dependent. And they spend most of their money on building studios in their various state-of-the-art studios, but nothing on programming.
It's really interesting. Yeah, well, because the programming would probably have a slant. I mean, some of the good program, remember, it was always brought to you by the oil companies, actually.
Right, that's why they call it the Petroleum Broadcasting System.
Well, right. So there's the BBC, and I know that Armando produces The Thick of It. I don't know if that's a BBC show. It might be one of their other, you know, commercial television networks.
Uh-huh. So the film is playing here just in the one theater in Los Angeles.
Pasadena's, Lemley's, I understand. I don't see that, but on our list, It shows that the Lemleys will open in Encino a week from now.
Yeah, on Friday, July the 21st, I'll be opening at the Sunset Five and in Encino and all over the country. But it's playing down there at the...
It's at the Landmark right now, that really great theater, actually, down near the West Side Pavilion.
Right, where they show you to your seat. Well, Mimi, thank you for this movie. I know that the director gets most of the thanks because he's clearly an amazing combination too of being half Scottish and half Italian.
I know. I love that. I know. Very unusual. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us. And again, I can't recommend this movie enough. In the Loop. It's the funniest thing that I've seen for a long time.
So, healthcare, not warfare. I just want to remind the audience, people are still dying in these wars, and we don't have healthcare yet. So there's still work to do, but it was my privilege to be in this movie, to be an actress, and you know, to have a career where I can do something like this is pretty great. Thanks, Ian, for having me.
Oh, a pleasure, Mimi. Again, Mimi Kennedy, the star of the, one of the stars of this movie that's out now, In the Loop. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Anthony Castillo, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.